From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Sam Woods. Today, we're exploring the reality of immigration in Wisconsin.
We'll discuss the state's immigrant history and our perceptions of Latino communities.
We talk about Latino immigrants as being newcomers, as being exotic, as being strangers in communities, as opposed to thinking of them as being another chapter in Wisconsin's long history.
We'll look at how losing migrant workers would affect key Wisconsin industries and how the deportation process currently works.
And we'll explore what the messaging about a mass deportation does to immigrant communities.
There were many kids in the school who were being bullied. It really was that Pandora's box of, like, the worst of humanity, you know, feeling that they could come out.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Sam Woods.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for joining us.
Although Latino people have lived in Wisconsin nearly as long as it's been a state, historian Sergio Gonzalez says Latino communities are often seen as perpetual outsiders. Gonzalez is the author of Mexicans in Wisconsin and Strangers No Longer, Latino Belonging and Faith in 20th Century Wisconsin.
His work explores how Latinos have integrated into Wisconsin communities, the impact of cultural exchange, and perceptions of immigrants. Gonzalez joins us to talk about the history of Latino immigration in Wisconsin and what it looks like today. Sergio, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
So I think there's this misperception that Latino immigration is a relatively new phenomenon in rural Wisconsin especially. But as your work has found, that's not the case. When do we first start to see large groups of Latino immigrants coming to rural Wisconsin?
Yeah. So, you know, we know that Latinos have been in the state of Wisconsin since the late 19th century, but Latinos have been moving beyond urban spaces since the first decades of the 20th century. And, you know, they went out looking for the same opportunities that European immigrants had been looking for before them. And that was better economic opportunity in farming. And so when a lot of agricultural industries began to turn to migrant labor to supplement, basically to kind of have that larger labor source, to really ramp up the efforts. 1920s, 1930s, especially after World War II, we started to see large communities of Latinos moving into these spaces. So whether it was Texas Mexicans who are American citizens migrating up here, but also Mexican nationals who were brought in as part of the Bracero program in the 1940s. Puerto Rican migrant workers, American citizens brought in to work as well. Jamaicans, people from Belize, from the Bahamas, all in the 1940s and 1950s going to all parts of rural Wisconsin.
You mentioned something interesting inside of that, the Bracero Project. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. In 1942, the United States, of course, is ramping up the wartime effort. Young men are going overseas to serve in the armed forces. People are moving out of rural spaces to find really good jobs and industrial labor in cities. And so farmers need labor to continue this work, specifically to feed men overseas. And so what does the U.S. government do? It signs an agreement with the Mexican government to basically ship Mexican nationals into the United States. And when I say ship, I mean that explicitly because they were coming over as imported workers. They would sign these limited-term contracts where they would go and work in industries all across the country, in railroads, but specifically in farming. And so Wisconsin, which of course depended on workers to do things like the cherry industry, the cucumber industry, sugar beets, you name it, needed workers to fill those roles. And they found them in places like Mexico, and they found them in the Caribbean as well, black migrants who would arrive here to work all across the state.
Yeah. Now, a movement to deport people is really what happens after that. People who had come to help farming and other production throughout the country, it really kicks off in the 1950s, and it becomes the largest deportation effort in U.S. history. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, these things are intimately connected. You know, the Bracero program in the 1940s makes very clear that there are economic opportunities in the United States and there's employment opportunities here. Unfortunately, that program for those Mexican nationals back in Mexico are pretty limited because they're limited term contracts and there's only a certain amount of spots that are available. But that doesn't mean there's only a certain amount of jobs available in the United States. And so at the same time that the United States opens up this guest worker program in 1942, we also saw the beginning of a rise of undocumented immigration from Mexico into the United States. And so you have workers coming over who perhaps had not been able to apply for the Bracero program, but they still need to provide for themselves and for their families. They cross the border surreptitiously without legal documentation, and they go wherever someone will offer them a job, including here in Wisconsin, across the Midwest, all across America. And so with this growing undocumented population, some Americans, of course, become very alarmed that there are these people who are existing in this country who don't have citizenship, who don't have a formal relationship with the state. In the early 1950s, amidst economic recessions, the federal government decides to initiate a very vast deportation scheme. President Eisenhower calls it Operation Wetback. And its intention is basically to round up all of these people who have coming to this nation, have been recruited into the country to do this work. It destabilizes communities, it destabilizes economies, and it's pretty disruptive. Unfortunately, what it also sets is a pattern that future presidential administrations follow. Whenever there's an economic recession, they will turn to similar tactics to round up these people who are now seen as surplus labor and send them back to their home countries.
Looking at this idea of the country being full, especially, I think if you go to a lot of small towns in Wisconsin, you might not think that's the case. There are so many small towns throughout the state of Wisconsin that are really losing population, losing people. And in fact, Latina immigration has helped a number of communities. So looking at that whole picture, right now, how would you describe the relationship between Latinos and the overall communities in rural Wisconsin towns?
I mean, I would say it's complicated, Joy. I mean, I think you're pointing to a very real fact, which is if you look at the material circumstances of some parts of our state, it's very clear that there has been demographic decline and that the prospects of these spaces, if we look in the next 10 years, much less the next 50 years, are pretty dim, right? If we just think about, like, what will the replacement of communities actually look like? In many of these spots, Latino migration, in-migration into these locations represents the only form of vitality in terms of kind of reviving some of these spaces. And we can look at that in different spaces. We could talk about economically in terms of the labor market. We could look at schools and kind of the growth and the regrowth of elementary schools and kindergarten programs that perhaps had declining population over the last few decades. We can talk about that in cultural spaces and social spaces and the way in which Latinos kind of revive some of these spaces as well with their own traditions and their own customs. That, however, if we talk about the material, it's very different from the way people feel things. And it's hard to separate the fact that perhaps many rural Wisconsinites have this sentiment that they've been left behind, that they've been abandoned, that they don't have the resources they think they need. And it's hard to disentangle whether or not that's true or not. It's the way in which people feel. And that manifests in many different ways. Sometimes people can find a sense of solidarity with newcomers and say, we have similar circumstances here. Perhaps we can find a way to bind ourselves as a community. But unfortunately, oftentimes what that actually means is that the newcomer is seen as someone who's invading a space and someone who's there to take the remaining last bits of resources, as opposed to seeing that person as someone who brings opportunity, someone who brings a new future for that location.
Yeah. It's interesting just how many communities really celebrate their immigrant past in small towns in Wisconsin and then do seem to have a reluctance, let's say, to accept new people into these communities. What would you say are some of the overall misunderstandings about Latinos in rural Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think you're keying on one of the things that has always bedeviled me as a lifelong Wisconsinite, but as also someone who is the son of Latino immigrants, Mexican immigrants to the state, that Wisconsin is very proud of certain aspects of its immigrant past. And we see that reflected in kind of the cultural sites that we celebrate, whether it's a place like Old World Wisconsin or, you know, our beer culture, which is very solidly based in our German or Swiss past, or cheese. I mean, all of these different things, bratwurst, right? All these things that kind of make Wisconsin what it is. We can say this very clearly. Wisconsin, it's proud of its immigrant history. And yet, when we talk about its immigrant present and its immigrant future, we sometimes draw lines about what is authentically Wisconsin. And so we talk about Latino immigrants as being newcomers, as being exotic, as being strangers in communities, as opposed to thinking of them as being another chapter in Wisconsin's long history of immigrant belonging and immigrant making into this space. And so, you know, one of the things I would hope people continue to wrestle with as we look at a place like Arcadia, Wisconsin, that has been absolutely transformed. And Arcadia is kind of the space that people often refer to, but it is a perfect case study. And it's one that I think is going to be replicated in other parts of Wisconsin over the next few decades, is how do Latino immigrants arrive within a longer history of remaking spaces as part of an immigrant tradition, but what new things are they introducing into this space as well, right? So that Latinos don't have to be shoehorned into this idea of what it means to be a Wisconsinite, what it means to belong, what are the things you need to throw off about yourself in order to fit into this space. Because, you know, when we think about hospitality, this kind of guest and host relationship, we need to begin to trouble that and to understand that Latinos are not guests in Wisconsin. They have been here for over 100 years. And if people are being honest with themselves, they're going to be here for another 100 more.
Yeah. Now, we are in a very specific moment in our history, both as a state and a nation. Wisconsin is, of course, a swing state. We have a big election coming up. And we have one candidate who is really proposing some extreme changes. He is proposing the largest deportation effort in U.S. history. We, of course, talked about what happened in the 1950s. And if you Google some of the images from that time, you're going to see a lot of people in basically cattle cars who are being driven to concentration or relocation camps. It was a really ugly time. And we're talking about at least what he's proposing, candidate, former President Donald Trump, something much larger than what happened at that time. What are the realities of what that would mean for Wisconsin communities?
I don't think anybody can actually wrap their head around what this would materially, physically mean. Because, you know, first of all, there is the outright lie that he mentions that there are, you know, 20 million undocumented people in this country, which is, you know, nearly double of the number that are actually living in this country, that have been living here for decades. But if we wrap around our heads, you know, in a four-year term that he would be responsible for detaining and deporting 11 million people in the United States. I don't think anybody can actually imagine what that would look like physically, but also the allocation of resources this would entail. What would it mean to communities to have to reallocate policing and law enforcement resources to do this type of work, much less the reality of what this would mean for economies all across the state? And I don't think listeners would be surprised to know, of course, that the first place I think of is our dairy industry. Wisconsin, of course, is the number two dairy producer in the United States, number one in our hearts, of course, but number two in terms of production. And that's an industry that is heavily dependent on immigrant labor, right? The majority of workers who work in the dairy industry today are immigrant, and the majority of those workers are undocumented. Now, we have wrestled with this question numerous times over the last decade here in Wisconsin because our state legislature and local common councils have tried to pass legislation that would force local law enforcement to act as an auxiliary arm of immigration and customs enforcement. These are often known as like 287G agreements, secure communities agreements. You know, our state legislature in 2016 tried to pass a similar law for the entire state, and they didn't get passed. Why did that law not get passed in 2016? Because dairy farmers picked up the phone and called their legislators and called the governor and reminded them that were these laws to pass, these industries would be devastated. And so when we think about how people are going to vote in the 2024 election, it's sometimes hard to wrap our heads around the way in which people might vote based on rhetoric, based on vibes, based on perhaps some mythic idea of what they want the country to be and what the material reality would be for them, their families, the industry that makes this state America's Dairyland.
Well, we will see what the future holds. Sergio, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you, John.
Sergio Gonzalez is an assistant professor of history at Marquette University and the author of the books Mexicans in Wisconsin and Strangers No Longer, Latino Belonging and Faith in 20th Century Wisconsin.
Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand.
Coming up, we'll explore what the deportation process looks like right now and what that could mean for future mass deportation attempts.
But first, we'll look at what mass deportation could mean for Wisconsin's economy, especially the dairy industry. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. En tierra ajena.
You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Sam Woods.
And I'm Joy Powers. John Rosenau's ancestors immigrated to western Wisconsin in the 1850s. His great-grandfather refused to speak English, and his family founded a church that held sermons in German for 60 years.
He's now a dairy farmer and has hired immigrant labor primarily from Mexico since the 1990s. He explains how his region knowingly depends on immigrant labor, but will vote to deport them anyway. He starts with a day in the life of a dairy farmer.
My average work day now, since I'm the owner and I do a lot of sitting in the office, is different than it used to be. But it used to be you'd get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go and milk the cows, feed them and clean them out and stuff like that. And you get done with that maybe by 9, 10 o'clock. And then after that, you do your field work or your mechanical work or anything else you got to do, like go to town. And then you'd milk the cows again at night, approximately 12 hours from when you started in the morning. That was optimum. And that was 7 days a week, holidays, always. Everybody locally did the same thing. There were within 3 miles of a radius of my farm, there were 23 dairy farms. And so school had to start at a certain time because people had to get done with chores. Church had to start at a certain time because people had to be done with chores in the morning. And even football games at night had to start at 8 o'clock, so people had time to milk the cows and get to the games. And that's all changed now. I think there's maybe 3 or 4 farms within 3 miles of us now, but the same number of cows.
Well, I can imagine with less farms but the same number of cows that hired labor is more important now for dairy farmers than it was, say, a generation ago.
Absolutely. Probably 20, 25 years ago, things changed dramatically. And we got to be more cows on farms. And that was an economic thing because people, like when I started farming over 50 years ago, the margin was 50%. So if you took in $100,000, you had $50,000 profit. Back 50 years ago, you didn't have that much income, but it still was 50%. Now we're at, on a good year, you're probably getting an 8% margin. So you have to have a lot more animals and a lot more volume in order to make a living nowadays. And so that has changed a lot. And because of that, you'd either have to have 12, 15 kids, or you have to hire people to work for you.
We have a presidential candidate, Donald Trump, who has built a campaign around mass deportation of undocumented immigrants. Let's say he is elected and he's able to do it. How could the loss of undocumented immigrants affect dairy farming and all of the industries that directly rely on dairy farming? I'm thinking meat packing, canning, cheese processing. How would these industries be affected by this loss of labor?
It's doing step by step. So they took all the employees away from dairy farms. So the dairy farms would have to sell all their cows. So 90% of the cows in Wisconsin and probably in the country would go away. They would go to packing plants. Packing plants are staffed by immigrants. They're the ones that would have to kill the cows and make it into meat. And the market would be flooded with meat, but there wouldn't be any milk or dairy products or cheese or butter or ice cream to buy. That would go away from our diet. And once all that meat was consumed, that would go away. And all you'd be able to eat basically is corn and beans and some vegetables.
Keeping on the theme of if mass deportations, if Trump's promise of a mass deportation comes true, what effect would the loss of these people mean for your community more generally?
Well, Ashley Furniture would have to shut down. So all the people that work there, and I think there's 5,000, I don't know how many are immigrants, they would most likely have to find a different job if they could. Pilgrim's Pride, a chicken processing plant would have to shut down and they would have to find different work. All the farms that are integrated through Pilgrim's Pride with chicken coops that rely on pilgrims to make the mortgage and stuff like that would probably lose their farms. The school would be decimated, and so there would only be 25% or 20% of the number of people living there now. The other part is that a lot of the people, kids in school, are citizens. So if you deport their parents and leave the citizens here that are 10 years old or 8 years old, how are they going to survive? So they would have to follow their parents home, and they're citizens.
In your experience, have you noticed differences in immigration enforcement under Democratic versus Republican presidents?
No. That's the simple answer. There's no. I know of one farm in the last 10 years that they came and checked documents, and he is still farming today, and he's got his documents in order now, but he was really concerned, and it cost him quite a bit of money, and he almost lost the farm because of it. But I know a lot of people, a lot of farmers, and that's the only one that I know of.
So without seeing differences in immigration enforcement in your region between Democratic and Republican presidents, including Trump, why would someone who hires undocumented labor or depends on an industry that depends on undocumented labor support mass deportations now?
What I've been told by those people is that he doesn't really mean that. Back in 2016 or 20, whenever it was that he was running, he was saying the day one he's going to deport everybody. There was somebody in California that was a big Trump supporter, and he had the dairy farmer. So we called him up and we asked him, you know, why are you saying that you support Trump and he's going to take all your employees away? Oh, he said, Trump assured him that he didn't mean me. And so I would assume that's what people think. But all we can do is go on history. And so he became president. He had the power to do whatever he wanted to, I guess, and he didn't do it. What we found at that point was that our employees became very concerned. And a lot of the people working here left, went home to Mexico, and dairy farmers were running about four or five people short. And everybody else had to pick up the slack, and everybody was working all the time. And then after about 7 or 8 months, everybody's came back because they knew that he wasn't going to do what he said he was going to do, and nothing changed. So I think based on that, we can assume the same thing now.
So if I can paraphrase, and let me know if this is the correct characterization of what you're saying, is that from your perspective, the calls for mass deportation now, it's about fear as much as it is about policy. So the fear that undocumented people, we're going to come after you, so you better self-deport now. Is that a fair characterization? Is that kind of how you see it? That it's the fear is the point?
A lot of people have no interaction with immigrants. And so they rely, their opinions are based off of somebody else's opinion. And so they listen to somebody else that badmouths immigrants, and they believe that. And because they haven't taken the time to really get to know an immigrant or study the thing. Because you're busy and you have a lot of things that you want to do in life, and you don't have time to study everything. So some issues don't touch it very much, so you don't worry about it. And one of them is immigration. A person in town or something, or somebody out in the country that never sees an immigrant but watches TV, and they have to have an opinion, so they listen to somebody on TV or somebody in online or whatever talk about immigration, and they base their opinions on that.
That was John Rosenow, dairy farmer and owner of Rosenhome Dairy and Cow's Moe Compost in Cochrane, Wisconsin. You can hear an extended interview at WUWM.com covering John's own immigration story, the mechanics of hiring undocumented labor, and individual versus structural racism.
This summer at the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, attendees waved signs saying, "Mass deportation now." Since then, it's become a rallying cry for conservatives who see undocumented immigration as the number one issue facing Americans. Former President Donald Trump has promised to launch the largest deportation program in U.S. history on the first day of his administration.
Trump has vowed to deport as many as 20 million people, despite there only being a suspected 11 million undocumented immigrants in the country. This has raised concerns that a new Trump administration would deport lawful immigrants as well.
But regardless of status, immigration lawyer Davran Oderchik says Trump would likely need to break current laws to deport these millions of people with the immediacy he's seeking. Oderchik represents people facing deportation, and he walks us through what the deportation process looks like right now.
Who are the types of people who might end up in immigration court?
Okay, so I would put them into two broad categories. So category one would be recent arrivals, but in from the southern border, who recently came into the United States, either entering without inspection or going to a port of entry and is simply asking for asylum or potentially being paroled in at some point by the Biden administration. So there's a big chunk of people in immigration court that just arrived within the past few years. The other category would be everyone else, and there's many different sort of subcategories of that group. For instance, people that lack immigration status and have lived here for, you know, a significant amount of time, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years.
Is this a person I might consider undocumented?
Yeah, that's a term used, because there really isn't an exact legal definition for someone who lacks status. So some say undocumented, some say unauthorized. Of course, some people say illegal. But we're kind of referring, I think, to the same person, someone who lacks status. They don't have permanent residence. They don't have a valid, what's called a non-immigrant visa. They don't have status. So there are a lot of people in immigration court that have been here for years. Typically, those folks will get into immigration court probably because they got convicted of something, an OWI, other offenses. That's one of the main ways that Immigration and Customs Enforcement learns about someone. They're in a local jail. They'll place a detainer on them. ICE will take them to custody, and they'll either remain detained or they'll get bonded out at some point.
Have you had clients that were caught up in immigration raids, and that's how they end up in immigration court?
Yes, that does happen. So let me first tell you that I don't know all of the inner workings of ICE, but I will say that it's not easy for them to carry out a raid. They have to do some intel. They have to figure out sort of where this person is. They want to make sure that if they go there, the person's going to be there.
Do they have to have a specific person in mind? They can't just go into a business where they believe undocumented people are working?
They have to have a specific person in mind. But what has happened frequently, and I've seen this, is that they will go to a house looking for someone. That person no longer lives there. There are new people that live there who happen to lack status. And ICE being ICE will just say, well, you'll do. So they'll take the person in, and it's really hard to suppress evidence in immigration court. It's a bit counterintuitive, but immigration it's civil. It's not criminal. So the constitutional rights that criminal defendants have don't exactly attach to folks that are placed into immigration court. So if there's, for instance, a Fourth Amendment violation, in order to really suppress that, there are a number of things that you have to do beyond what a criminal defendant normally would have to do. You have to show that it's egregious, to show that it's something really, really bad. So a type of thing is that if there's racial profiling, could be something that could serve as a basis to suppress evidence in immigration court. Knocking on a door and the person then lets that person in, and then they start pestering that person and asking about status, and they say, okay, I don't have status. That's going to be difficult to suppress in immigration court. That does happen, where they will go in and raid, and they won't find the person that they're looking for. And so they'll just take the person that they find.
What does the deportation process look like from start to finish?
It starts with ICE filing to the immigration court a document that's called a notice to appear. It outlines the allegations. And in typical cases, if someone entered without inspection, meaning that they entered illegally, they entered without inspection, it would literally be four allegations. You're not a citizen of the United States. You're a citizen of Mexico. You entered at an unknown place or an unknown time. You did so without being admitted to parole. Therefore, you're subject to removal under this statute. Assuming for the sake of argument that removability is established, the second phase of immigration court is there any type of relief or application that the person can file that they can remain here? That's often where the big fight is. Do they have an application, and are they eligible? And if they are eligible, should it be granted?
When it comes to representing your clients, what are some of the tools at your disposal to fight a deportation attempt?
It's going to depend on the individual circumstances of a case. So let me give you an example of the main form of defense for someone who's been here for a while, who doesn't have immigration status. The main form of defense in immigration court is called cancellation of removal. A better way of understanding that is that it's a green card application for permanent residence that can only be applied for if you're facing deportation, so you're in immigration court. And cancellation and removal for folks that don't have status, there's four requirements. One, that they have to be here physically present in the United States for at least 10 years before proper initiation of proceedings. Second is that they can't have any inadmissible or deportable criminal convictions. Three is that you have to demonstrate that you're a person of good moral character for the past 10 years. And then the last requirement, and this is the one that can often result in denial, and I'm going to give you the exact terminology under the law. You have to demonstrate that removal is going to result in extreme and exceptionally unusual hardship to a qualifying family member, which for most cases, just to kind of cut to the chase, would be like a U.S. citizen kid. So exceptional and extremely unusual hardship is the standard. And what does that mean? Well, there isn't a set definition, but most immigration judges will take the position that it's got to be a child that has special needs, either has a significant medical issue that really requires attention here in the United States, a significant developmental delay, a serious psychological issues. And this area of the law, to me, is it's really immoral.
It does feel a little ghoulish for the U.S. government to decide whose children really need them.
It is, and that's why I consider it to be an immoral law. And it's anti-kid to kind of start wading into politics. It does burn me up when you have politicians talk about, like, oh, you know, it's about the children, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then they are supporting immigration law that is very much anti-American kid.
Yeah. When you hear Donald Trump's plan to deport millions of undocumented immigrants, what do you think of that? What do you think the implications are potentially on your job? Or do you even think of this as being feasible?
Well, if he just wanted to do this just in violation of the law, then he would probably be able to achieve significantly more than what I think is achievable within what we currently have. So look, I mean, the law is this, is that if you're here in the United States, been here for a while, you've never been deported, don't have an order of removal, and ICE becomes aware of you, you're entitled to go to immigration court. And that's a process. Just can't sort of disregard that unless you're going to disregard it. So I don't really know. I think that really probably what they're going to try to do is they're going to try to probably sow fear in the immigrant communities with the hope that people will self-deport, that they'll just be so kind of afraid and they'll leave. I don't know if that will work or not. And I think people that have been here for a significant amount of time, they have roots. They've got U.S. citizen kids. They have jobs. I don't think they're just going to get up and leave. But I don't know. I mean, we'll see. I think that what I'm expecting is that they're probably going to go after probably new arrivals first and folks with criminal records and things like that. I think they're going to have to be selective with what resources they have. But this idea that they're just going to kind of go around and just sort of grabbing people off the street, I'm having a hard time envisioning that happening. But then again, you know, we don't know exactly what will happen in the future, do we?
Davrin Oderchik is an immigration lawyer based in Milwaukee.
Coming up, we'll look at the role of fear in calls for mass deportations. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Sam Woods. To end our discussion on the reality of immigration in Wisconsin, we ask, what is the point of mass deportations?
Christine Newman-Ortiz has more than 20 years of experience as an immigrant workers' rights organizer and is the executive director of Voces de la Frontera Action. She describes how with a policy like mass deportation, fear of deportation is the point.
But with Wisconsin immigrants not having access to basic necessities like a driver's license and any interaction with law enforcement being a potential disaster, fear lingers. Newman-Ortiz begins by explaining an immigration raid.
When a raid happens, it can often happen at a home. And it is very, very traumatic. We had one pastor, this was under the Trump years, who was from Colombia. She had come to the U.S. as a, you know, seeking protection from the cartels, from the religious school that she was the director of there. And she had an order of deportation. This was someone who had a good record and everything, but she became a target of deportation. And when they came to her home, they came as if it were some dangerous person there. And she, her husband, her husband's brother, her daughter who had DACA, and her small grandchild who was with the daughter, you know, were basically caught up in all of this with, you know, armed presence. And because of our intervention with other faith groups, we were able to put the brakes on the daughter being deported, who would have been separated from her daughter. And she had DACA. She should not have been deportable. And the pastor and her husband and brother-in-law did end up in deportation. And, you know, it was something that happened very, very quickly. It was very traumatic. And the community came together, all these groups of faith went to Chicago as a regional office to really try to do everything to advocate for the release of, this pastor and to no avail. And so I feel like it traumatizes children, it leaves people in poverty, and it traumatizes the larger community around them. So there are no benefits to deportation. And the kind of program that Trump is talking about doing would be very militarized operations, detention camps by airports to quickly remove people and basically stripping them of what rights we have leaned into in the past, what limited rights people had. So it's a very awful experience. And I think just people have to take for just a moment to think about, if I were in their shoes, how would I feel about that, you know, to really get a sense of it.
You mentioned Trump's first term. Can you take me through his first term and you know, in your world on the ground? What were the battles you were fighting, fighting on the ground during Trump's first term?
When it was announced that Trump had won the presidency, one of the most immediate things that we experienced is that there were many kids in the school who were being bullied. And it really was that Pandora's box of like the worst of humanity, you know, feeling that they could come out. And so, yeah, a lot of there was a lot of bullying in the schools that we had to intervene in. And it wasn't just immigrant students either. I mean, there were students who were also like Black students. There were also LGBTQ students. And it really was, you know, they were reflecting the ideas and opinions of kind of this larger society. And certainly what Trump was saying was okay. That was the beginning. And we also worked with both at the city level and at the county level to build a tremendous resistance against efforts to implement Trump's policies of mass deportation that included, one, removing all kind of enforcement priorities of who's deportable, making all 11 million people deportable. That's what he implemented right away in the first 100 days. And then the other thing was to grow a program called 287G that turns local law enforcement into an arm of immigration that legalizes racial profiling. But that program grew under former President Trump and was a vehicle, a very critical vehicle for the policy of mass deportations. Here in Milwaukee, we had a, when former Sheriff Clark announced that he was going to implement this program, in 2 weeks' time, we organized a day without Latinos and immigrants, a statewide general strike, and we estimate we had like 60,000 people come. And it was a complete shutdown of like schools, of businesses, and workers across all industries, hotels and restaurants, you know, construction. We had, you know, every industry that you can think of. And it was just like a sea, a wave of people. And it was peaceful. Voces has had used this strategy in the past as well, of scale, to defeat other threats in the state legislature under former Governor Walker. And then earlier with the national bill that there was an effort to pass. And so the use of the strike, statewide community strike, has been very, very powerful, and it makes us very unique here in the national movement because we've executed that more than once.
So while Donald Trump's immigration plan revolves around mass deportations, Kamala Harris's plan seems to focus more on security at the border. For example, hiring more border agents as opposed to deporting millions of immigrants who are already here. So there are definitely differences in platform, definitely differences in rhetoric. I think that's undeniable. But in your two-decade experience as an organizer, do you notice differences in immigration enforcement strategy here in Wisconsin when a Democrat is president versus a Republican?
I would say that the best example of the disappointment with the Democratic Party is that when President Obama had, you know, basically two terms, and when he was elected, especially the first one, he ran on a pro-immigrant platform, is obviously the son of immigrant parents, and was someone where there was a lot of hope in that. And it's very shameful that he ended up with the nickname Deporter in Chief because under his administration, they took a strategy that was about moving farther and farther to the right to try to win some kind of concession that never came. So under Democrats, under the Obama administration, it resulted in the whole movement eventually shifted from lobbying to mass civil disobedience. Like here in Wisconsin, we shut down the ICE, central location, kind of detention processing center, as part of a national movement that eventually resulted in DACA being passed for Dreamers, where the young people as well were doing disobedience actions during the lead up to the campaign. When it became obvious that legislatively through Congress there wasn't going to be a change, but there was enforcement priorities were won by the movement, and DACA was won by the movement. And that's really the same attitude that we take. It's not that, we're hoping that all we have to do is elect Kamala Harris and she's going to fulfill her promise, which was important to say that it, earned immigration reform with a path to citizenship as a priority. It was important for her to say that during the Democratic National Convention. But it's not going to come without movement pressure. That is very, very clear.
What are some concrete ways immigrant rights can be affirmed in Wisconsin today?
One policy that would really help immigrant families is for people who are U.S. citizens to lobby their state elected officials in support of restoring state driver's licenses for immigrants. So in Wisconsin, for decades, we were one of 10 states that granted driver's licenses without requiring a Social Security number. So you still had to prove that you live in Wisconsin, who you are, and pass the driving test and all of that. And that was a very good program. When Real ID was implemented in 2007 in Wisconsin, it really fell to the states to create a driver's card that would then allow immigrants who lack a Social Security number or others who don't have a Social Security number to have a new driver card available. And that means that people who had a driver's license, when it expired, they weren't able to renew it. So they're driving, they can't drive legally, but out of necessity, they drive. Young people coming of age can no longer get a driver's license, or someone who moves to the state because of their immigration status. And the stakes are really high for people who don't have a driver's license because they live in fear that a second offense driving without a license can lead to a criminal charge and put you up on the radar screen for immigration and could lead to deportation, separation from your family, even though you've lived here for decades and have a good record. But just the fact that you can't get a driver's license, people live in fear. It's a daily fear because it's a necessity. And it's something that is broadly popular because there's many people, including local law enforcement, sheriffs, and police that talk about how they don't want people to be afraid of them. So if you have a driver's license, people are not afraid to engage with law enforcement. So it's something that makes people feel more secure. And that's something that we're hopeful we can introduce in 2025 because this will be the first election where we have fair maps in place. And it means that in the state legislature, there's more accountability, more representation. So we're excited that since 2011, this is the first chance we're going to have to introduce a state driver's license bill that would have a real chance of getting passed and restoring that, that ability to legally drive here in Wisconsin again. And that's good for everybody. More people who are tested on the road, more people have access to insurance. It obviously is better for public safety, first and foremost. But obviously, it's also good for the economy, and it builds healthier families and healthier communities.
Well, Christine, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Marching together.
Christine Newman-Ortiz has more than 20 years of experience as an immigrant workers' rights organizer and is the executive director of Voces de la Frontera Action.
You can hear an extended interview on WUWM.com, covering Newman-Ortiz's organizing roots, the lingering effects of anti-immigrant rhetoric, and how the federal government still deputizes local law enforcement as deportation agents today. That's Lake Effect for today. I'm Sam Woods.
And I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand.
Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we're celebrating Halloween with a story about a Milwaukee firehouse that's supposedly haunted. We'll learn about one of Wisconsin's cryptids, and we'll bring you a special Halloween roundup of new local music.
That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.